Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today I'm talking to Megan Rossiter, who is a fellow hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor from Birth Ed. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, Erin. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you today. We're going to talk about hyperemesis today, aren't we?
Yes. My old friend, hyperemesis.
Arch enemy. Do you want to just introduce yourself first a little bit for anyone that doesn't know who you are? I'm sure everyone will know who you are, but just in case they don't.
Of course. So my name is Megan. I'm the founder of a company called Birth Ed. I work with families antenatally in their kind of birth preparation, similarly to Erin, actually, sort of providing families with information about their kind of choices and their rights and tools and techniques through hypnobirthing to kind of hopefully help them feel calm and confident kind of moving forwards into their birth, however that unfolds and however they want that to be. I'm also a mum to two boys and two little stars in the sky in between them. I have a six-year-old and a 1.5-year-old at the moment.
Oh, and you, I think hyperemesis is something that you're quite familiar with, isn't it, as a topic?
Yeah, so I suffered with hyperemesis with both of my successful pregnancies, so both of my children. I had hyperemesis throughout both of their pregnancies. If you don't know what hyperemesis is, we're talking like very, very extreme end of the pregnancy sickness spectrum. Severe nausea, severe vomiting, weight loss, all sorts of fun symptoms.
I think it's important to notice it is very different from morning sickness, isn't it?
Yeah, so pregnancy sickness in general, I suppose everybody will sit somewhere on the spectrum of it, from not having any at all to being on the kind of very, very, very severe end, which is considered to be hyperemesis gravidarum, which sort of translated from Latin literally translates as hyper meaning like too much, emesis meaning sickness, and gravidarum basically meaning of pregnancy, so sort of too much sickness in pregnancy. And everybody will sit somewhere on that spectrum. So some people will have pregnancy sickness, which is really horrible and unbearable and horrible nausea, but they are still able to go to work, still able to kind of eat and drink a little bit and just feeling really rotten, which I don't think should be still kind of like belittled, because that's still a really difficult experience. And hyperemesis is the very extreme end of that. It's really affecting your ability to function in your kind of day-to-day life. In kind of extreme circumstances, and in the past it would have been a life-threatening condition of pregnancy that women would have died from.
What alarm bells were ringing for you when you were pregnant and you thought, actually this isn't just pregnancy, like standard pregnancy sickness?
So I actually hadn't heard, so I was actually training as a midwife when I fell pregnant with my first son, and I actually hadn't heard of hyperemesis by this point in time. And I knew that people experienced pregnancy sickness. So when I was feeling sick, I thought it was pregnancy sickness, morning sickness that is kind of commonly known as. It certainly wasn't just in the morning. And it got to a point where I, you know, was completely unable to get out of bed. I was completely unable to move. I was being sick in the kind of early part of pregnancy, kind of 10, 12, 14, 16, it was creeping up and up times a day. And I think it was my husband eventually said to me, like, this can't be normal. There must be something that you could do. So I went to the GP and they told me something helpful, like, have you tried acupressure bands and eating ginger, and sent me on my way, which is a really common response that women get when they're visiting a GP or visiting or asking their midwife or anybody that isn't really familiar with diagnosing hyperemesis. I think it's a little bit of an insult, because if somebody has felt that their condition was so severe that they have sought out medical treatment, I mean, you'd have to be living on a desert island to have not considered, oh, have you heard of ginger? Have you heard of acupressure bands? Have you, you know, eaten little and often? All of these things usually women have tried by the time they're kind of getting to visiting a GP or speaking to somebody about it. So it actually took me, I think, a couple more trips to the GP where they gave me some medication to try, which I tried and it did absolutely nothing. And eventually got to a point where I was being sick between 30 and 40 times every day, completely unable to eat, completely unable to drink. Went to the GP for my 8th visit. And on leaving the GP with another prescription of something to try, I collapsed in the waiting room from dehydration. And it wasn't until that happened that they were like, oh, you should probably go to hospital. At which point I was rushed to hospital, and it took 8 separate people to get a cannula into me because I was so dehydrated. The kind of consultant on call anaesthetist had to come, and I think he cannulated my ankle, but to be honest, I have absolutely no memory of any of it. So I was basically just passed out on a bed and then spent time in hospital. That pregnancy was very difficult to access decent treatment, to get people to kind of take you seriously. There were quite a lot of different medications that I tried, eventually finding one that helped a little bit, which was called ondansetron, which is kind of one of the stronger antiemetics that I took in combination with a few other things. But essentially, it kind of continued throughout pregnancy. In that first pregnancy, I went back to work at 23 weeks. My work, ridiculously, working in maternity, they wouldn't let me come back for a phased return. They wouldn't let me do part time. It had to be full time or nothing. So I think I lasted 8 weeks, and then I went on maternity leave at like 31 weeks or something. And then took my last kind of anti-sickness tablet in labor. And then once he was born, it had kind of completely disappeared. For in that pregnancy, the second half, the kind of, well, the third trimester was probably a little bit easier in terms of it was managed with the medication that I was taking. Second pregnancy was much, much better managed. I went on steroids quite quickly in that pregnancy, which did help. They come with a multitude of side effects themselves, but I was taken much more seriously and I had much better treatment. I think in part because I knew exactly what I needed to ask for and what I wanted them to do for me. But yeah, it was very, very difficult.
Wow. And it seems crazy that it isn't, you know, so isn't it wasn't identified quicker, or that you had to go through so many GP appointments to get support, because there's 20,000 pregnancies a year that have hyperemesis. So which I guess kind of like on the greater scale of things is a small number, but that's still a lot of people that are potentially suffering with that. So what kind of things do you think somebody could say or could do to try and convince or advocate for themselves if they think they have hyperemesis when they go and see the GP?
I think the thing that's really difficult is that it's, you know, it's women, isn't it? You go to the GP and you're just moaning and you're not managing and you're not coping. And it's that sexism thing, I think, is where it starts from. You know, you just got to get on with it. And I think what we overlook is that, like, certainly most women I know are very good at getting on with it, and they will really have tried to go to work, and they will really have tried to look after their other child or whatever it is that they have to do day to day. And to be at a point, I think that in itself, from a kind of clinician perspective, if somebody is coming and they have already tried to go to work with this, and they have already tried to look after their other children with this, that in itself should be an alarm bell that actually it must be quite severe, that it's affecting their day-to-day life. In terms of kind of advocating for yourself, obviously, like, so much of my work is about how women can advocate for themselves. It's really hard to advocate for yourself when you're that unwell. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to say nearly impossible to advocate for yourself when you're that unwell. Mm-hmm. And one of the hardest things is getting other people to understand, not just clinicians, but friends, family, to understand what it is that is happening to you. Your body is literally dying, and without like treatment, you would be so severely dehydrated that it would certainly impact your pregnancy, if not impact your life. So it does require treatment. Often, if you do have like a supportive partner or somebody at home that is literally seeing what is happening, hopefully they can be your kind of advocate. I was very lucky. I had like my parents were around, and my husband obviously was kind of seeing what we were going through. And so they were very good at communicating with the people that were looking after me, as to kind of what I needed and what it was I was experiencing. Obviously, not everybody has that. And sometimes it can even be a battle to convince partners, to convince family and friends that you aren't just feeling tired and need a lay down, but that you like, that you literally cannot function day to day. There's an excellent charity called Pregnancy Sickness Support who have a helpline, a web chat, a forum. I think they've got a Facebook group, like any way you could think of getting in touch with them. And they have, and they are really, really good at, they have like a list of clinicians that you can get in touch with that are kind of listed as HG friendly. So if you're like, oh, I'm giving birth at this hospital, and I've been in and I haven't been taken seriously, then actually they could potentially give you the name of somebody to specific to ask to see. If you are not getting what you need from your GP, then potentially just asking to see a different GP within the same surgery, because there's usually more than one person that you can see. They can also provide you with like evidence-based information around the treatments that are available, so that you can kind of go with, if you need to print something out and take it with you, you can turn up and go, this is what I need, or this is what I'm experiencing, this is what I think I have. You know, I didn't get diagnosed with HG until I left hospital. That's the first time HG was actually mentioned to me. And it wasn't even mentioned. They gave me a sheet with hyperemesis gravidarum at the top of it. And I was like, oh, what's this? Nobody had thought to tell me that there is an actual condition of pregnancy that could make you that severely unwell. So certainly getting in touch with the charity if you're struggling. If you're not getting through with your GP, being quite explicit and just saying, can you make me an appointment with the early pregnancy unit? Different hospitals and different trusts work very differently. So some areas will have early pregnancy units that are like open access. So you can just turn up as if you were going to like a walk-in center. So some of the kind of, certainly the big London hospitals have like walk-in early pregnancy unit, where you would also go if you're experiencing bleeding or something in early pregnancy. And you can turn up there with hyperemesis if you're not being seen by your GP. Obviously you have to wait, which is potentially annoying. The weigh-in in some areas, which is actually really awful and horrible if you're feeling that ill, is through A&E. So if you think you're dehydrated and your GP's not taking you seriously, so dehydrated is like you've got a dry mouth, you're not drinking water, you're not passing urine. If you are passing urine, it's like small amounts and it's dark. Maybe your heart feels like it's racing, you feel faint, you feel woozy, like if you know, like if you've been out on a hot day, kind of those sensations. If you're experiencing that, then you go, okay, I'm potentially dehydrated. Now, if you cannot rehydrate yourself by drinking a drink, it doesn't have to be water. Most people with hyperemesis can't drink water. It might be Coke, it might be coffee, it might be milk, whatever it is that you can kind of stomach. If you cannot rehydrate yourself in that way by drinking several glasses of water throughout a day, then you're going to need like rehydration therapy, which is usually given through an IV. It can be done in what they call an ambulatory way, which means you go in just for the day or just for a few hours. They will put a cannula in, give you an IV, rehydrate you, and then if you then seem a little bit better, you could then go home and sleep at home. If you were so severely dehydrated that actually that wasn't getting your rehydration under control, you were still being sick, then they might admit you to hospital. And waiting in A&E in that situation is really hard. But if you haven't been able to kind of get through the GP way, then that is kind of an alternative, but definitely not something you would want to be doing if you're feeling that awful.
Yeah. So you mentioned having like IV fluids is, and you said earlier that your hyperemesis was better managed second time round. So is that one of the things that they were doing, kind of regularly giving you IVs, or was it just the medication that managed it better?
So second time round, because if you've had hyperemesis once, the chances of having it again are like really quite high. So we were kind of going in. Some people will have it again, but it won't be as bad. Some people will have it again, it'll be the same. Some people will have it again, it'll be worse. I didn't think I could get worse than the first time, but I managed to actually get it. So the actual symptoms that I experienced second time were worse, but the experience was better because I was just better looked after. And so going into it second time, we really, you know, if you've had hyperemesis in one pregnancy, to have another baby takes a lot of planning, because now you can't just lay in bed all day because you have a child that needs looking after. And so first of all, the timing of when we had a second baby, we had kind of considered in a lot of depth. So we wanted our eldest to have free childcare so that I didn't necessarily need to be having an income to pay for him to be in childcare. We wanted him to be potty trained. We wanted him to be old enough to kind of get a snack or get a bowl or wipe his own bum, whatever it is, like that he was reasonably self-sufficient. So by the time my second was born, he was 4.5. And so that was one part of our consideration. And the other part of the consideration, this was something that the charity actually suggested, is basically coming up with a care plan with your doctor in advance of getting pregnant. Because one of the things that has been shown to reduce the severity of hyperemesis is basically like really early medication. So medication from the minute you know you're pregnant rather than the minute you get symptoms. So I had approached my GP to come up with a care plan, and obviously it was met very reluctantly and they were not interested in creating any kind of care plan whatsoever. But now I wasn't feeling ill at this point in time, so it was much easier to advocate for myself. So I basically just said, okay, well, if you're not willing to do it, you need to make me an appointment with a consultant at the hospital and they can make this plan with me. So fortunately, she then made this appointment with an obstetrician at the hospital that I would be birthing under. And then I attended that appointment, and it still took a little bit of pushing from me, but I basically just needed it all written down. I needed the GP to be able to not feel scared about giving me medication in pregnancy. And that is probably like the biggest barrier. You know, we're many years out of it, but basically the thalidomide disaster of the kind of 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, whenever it was, where actually medicating sickness in pregnancy actually really did affect babies and led to lots of kind of malformations in pregnancy. I think a lot of GPs are still scared to prescribe drugs of any kind in pregnancy. And a lot of women are very scared to take drugs of any kind in pregnancy. But the drugs that are now given to treat pregnancy sickness and hyperemesis have like a long historical profile now of being used and being safe. And we also know that the impact of malnutrition and dehydration is actually potentially bigger on a baby and on a mum in pregnancy than any potential risk of any of the medications that might be prescribed. So what I needed was this to be written down by somebody at the hospital so that a GP could refer to it and just give me what I was asking for. And the other thing that I had kind of requested on there was basically to have open access to the early pregnancy unit. So anytime I said I need to be there, they would just expect me and I would be kind of welcome. And fortunately that did actually happen. And so I was going in, initially was going in 3 times a week for IV fluids, IV medication, and then all of the medication that was prescribed by the GP. But it just spiraled very, very quickly. And for me, that wasn't enough. But for a lot of women, that then would be enough. That would mean they could still sleep at home with their older child. And so it can potentially stop the hospital admission. So that was our like wish. But in the end, I ended up having several weeks in hospital in like the peak of COVID, which is not a fun time to be in hospital. But it did at that point, with kind of IV steroids and things like that, did get it under control.
So you got to a point where you could go back home then once the medication kind of kicked in.
Yeah, well, so I spent a week and a half in hospital on IV steroids, which they managed to put me onto like oral steroids. I went home within 2 hours of being at home. I'd been sick about 14 times. So we went straight back to hospital, and I spent another 3 weeks in hospital. So it was, yeah, a long hospital stay, but eventually got to a point where on the absolute like maximum dose of steroids on danzatron, something called metoclopramide, all sorts. I was literally rattling. I was a walking pharmacy. eventually got to a point where I could go home. Though I actually in both pregnancies moved in with my parents, because the first time we lived in like a small flat and any smell would just make you sick. So basically my husband couldn't even open the fridge without me being like, oh no. That's too much. And then second time, in terms of just kind of support with our eldest child, in terms of just like cleaning, self-care, all of those things that you can't manage. So I spent probably the first kind of 14, 16 weeks with them, and then eventually moved home and lived in my bed instead for a very long time.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds so hard. I can't imagine how difficult that must have been to cope with.
I genuinely don't think any description that I give of it will ever really explain to somebody what it's like to have hyperemesis. Like, you genuinely feel like you're dying, because you literally are. It's the hardest thing that I've ever done. It's extremely traumatic. The loneliness and the kind of emotional aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Certainly in my first pregnancy, like any kind of relationship or bonding with your baby was impossible, because they were just this thing, this like that you didn't know that they were who they were going to be. So you didn't have any kind of emotional attachment to them. They were basically just the reason for you feeling awful. Yeah. Second time, I then did know that I now loved my eldest son. So I did have the kind of foresight to be like, it's awful now, but it's going to be like a loved baby. But first time didn't have that at all. And then the other thing first time that really kind of contributed to it, the emotional aspect of it being so hard, was this kind of unwritten rule that you're not supposed to tell anyone that you're pregnant till you're 12 weeks.
Yeah.
Which I don't know where it comes from. I don't know why it's a thing, but it's something that we just kind of automatically prescribed to without actually considering whether that was something we wanted to do or not. So to all of my friends that I was seeing like every day at work and at uni, I just disappeared off the face of the planet. And some of them knew that I was in hospital, but had absolutely no idea why I was in hospital. Loads of my friends just thought I'd stopped replying to them. And I didn't have anybody to text to be like, oh, I'm feeling awful. So it was just like incredibly lonely. There wasn't anybody to kind of share the experience with. But second time, literally the minute we had a positive test, we were like, right, everybody needs to, you know, do like a formal announcement, but everybody that needed to know knew, and then they could help us. And so that would be my tip. If you're listening and you're like 8 weeks pregnant with hyperemesis, just like tell a few people that you think would then be helpful to you, and then they can help.
Yeah, I don't really know why we don't. I mean, I do know why. It's the worry that, you know, if you end up with a miscarriage, then it's, you know, you have to share the news. But I mean, personally, from somebody who has had miscarriages, I found it helpful for like my parents to know and friends to know, because dealing with that behind closed doors without anyone to talk to is also very difficult. So
yeah, I completely agree. And with both of the pregnancies that we lost, again, we told people straight away. I think it's different to like maybe not telling, like, well, maybe telling work if you've got hyperemesis, but in general you don't need to do like a big formal announcement. Mm. But to tell the people that are close to you that you're going to actually be seeing day to day, if your pregnancy is impacting you in any way, then like I personally, it made perfect sense for us to share it. And then it meant that when in the pregnancies that we did lose, one of them was an ectopic pregnancy, and again I was like in hospital. People would have been like, why, what's the matter with you? And you're like, well, actually it's this. And then people can actually understand and help, rather than just not knowing what to do or what to say.
Yeah, And I guess talking about it also helps raise awareness of it as well, because I don't think people are really aware of hyperemesis. You know, we all hear about morning sickness or pregnancy. I don't know why we call it morning sickness, because it's not just the morning. No,
even when it's kind of low level, it's for a few people, it's just the morning, but a lot of people are like, oh, it was actually in the evening, or.
Even just the nausea. I mean, like, I'm not by any means saying that mine was anywhere near as severe as yours, because I wasn't even sick, but even just feeling nauseous all the time is really horrible. It is really horrible.
I actually think the nausea is harder than the vomiting, because I mean, the vomiting is definitely not fun, and it was what contributes to you kind of being very dehydrated. But it was, you know, when you've got food poisoning or like a sick bug, and then you're sick. And then usually for like at least a few moments afterwards, you have that like, oh, like a relief from it. When you have hyperemesis, you don't get any relief. Like, you just, you're sick. And then then you feel just as nauseous after you've been sick as you did before. So it's that, yeah, the nausea to me was actually the like emotionally the really difficult thing to manage.
Yeah, I can't imagine how difficult it must have been. It sounds really, really hard. I really do appreciate you coming on to talk about it, though, because I do think that people need to be, the awareness does need to be raised about it, because I don't think it's something that's very commonly discussed. You know, I mean, I immerse myself in all things birth. You know, my Instagram is just birth. I literally don't look at anything else all day, and to be honest, we talk about everything else, and I very, very rarely see anything about hyperemesis. In fact, probably your last pregnancy stands out to me as one of the few times that I have seen it mentioned on social media. So I do think it's really important that we put information out about this, because I don't think it's discussed enough.
Yeah, I also think one of the kind of things that it's not actually widely understood in the kind of maternity world and like amongst midwives, because in the way that the NHS is structured, it generally falls under gynae rather than maternity. So at that stage of pregnancy, if you're seeing doctors or you're being cared for in hospital, you're seeing the gynae doctors, who do often cross over into obstetrics, but not always, and you're being looked after by gynae nurses. So you're not generally, like, day to day, if you're admitted to hospital, midwives aren't really seeing it unless you're extremely severe and being in hospital like after kind of 17-18 weeks. Which, even for people with very severe hyperemesis, like, most people would be hopefully managing kind of mainly at home or kind of in and out just for fluids at that point. So it's actually a very few number of women with hyperemesis that would actually be seen by a midwife regularly, because you've just got your kind of the booking appointment, and that's sort of it then, until, like, when's the next time you see a midwife after that? 16 weeks, and then not again until like potentially kind of 24-28 weeks, depending on how many babies you've had. So they're not actually necessarily seeing the kind of full throes of hyperemesis.
So you mentioned pregnancy sickness support. That's .org.uk. I've got it up on my screen because I was looking at it earlier. Is there anywhere else that people can go for support? Or is there any, I don't know if there's any like groups or social media accounts maybe that you might...
There's a Facebook group that is called... I'll find it. I'll show you what it's called.
Put you on the spot. I know there's lots of fantastic social media, like Facebook groups and things generally around, and Twitter accounts. And I think sometimes I imagine it would be really helpful to speak to other people who are suffering from the same condition.
Yeah. So definitely in my first pregnancy, the thing that I found quite helpful was on the pregnancy sickness support website, they have like an anonymous forum. And certainly if you've not had hyperemesis before, some of the experiences that you might be having, some of the thoughts that you might be having, some of the questions that you might want to be asking, are often things that you don't necessarily feel comfortable asking if people know that it's you. Although I think you can do like anonymous posts in Facebook groups now, can't you?
Yeah.
Which you couldn't back then. But some of them can sometimes feel like quite embarrassing or quite, I don't know, you're a bit worried, like said, feelings about not liking your baby or wanting to have an abortion or wanting to die. These are not things necessarily that people kind of feel comfortable putting out in the open. And some of the side effects of medication is having, like, in my first pregnancy, I had an impacted bowel, and it's like, literally, how do I get a poo out? Like, these are not necessarily questions that people feel totally comfortable asking publicly. I found the Facebook group. There is, if you're in the UK, it's called Hyperemesis Gravidarum and Pregnancy Sickness brackets UK group. And I'll send Erin a link for it. That's like a closed private group, which is, if you want a kind of a forum where you're actually chatting to other people, that can be quite a helpful group to be in. Pregnancy Sickness Support also have a Facebook group, which is like post HG. So for people that have experienced hyperemesis, because it's such a trauma, as such a in the kind of perinatal period, it has like long-term, both like emotional and physical impacts for people. So things like if you're being sick 40 times a day, your teeth are going to be like in pieces. And so it's a place where people often discuss things like dental health, or often people might develop like reflux or something because of the kind of the experience that they've had during pregnancy, and the kind of emotional conversations about like, do we want to have another child? Did people have it again? What did they do that helped? All of those conversations happen in that space, which is, again, I think a really, really kind of helpful resource if you want to kind of chat to people. There are a few kind of influencers and people kind of online that have shared. I know that Susie Verrill shared her experience quite kind of openly and explicitly, and I imagine she's got some stuff kind of on her Instagram if people want to kind of go and follow. So there is a kind of a community there, but it really isn't shared like publicly as widely as I think it's experienced by people at all.
So what's your Instagram, people want to come and find you?
I'm at birth_ed. I think on there I've got like a highlight in my stories of all of the kind of questions that people ask me about being pregnant with hyperemesis and kind of what that experience was like. If people have got kind of more questions, or they just want to kind of see it, promise you I haven't put any pictures of my actual vomit on there, but there's sort of like photos of hospital, photos of like my very, very skinny face, all of those, yeah, what that kind of experience was like day to day.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Megan. I really appreciate you giving your time to chat today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I'll put in the podcast bio, I'll put all of the links to your
amazing
Instagram and the pregnancy support website. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing today. I really hope that lots of people find it useful.
Thanks for having me.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.